Welcome back to Art Smack. This is episode 29. I'm your host, Matt Capasso, and I'm here with
Jerry Gagosian.
Jerry, fresh back from Basel, Switzerland. How was it?
It was fantastic. I did have a very good time. What can I say? Switzerland, I can't imagine a single person going to Switzerland and saying, it's not nice there.
I also can't imagine a single person going to Switzerland and not saying, holy shit, the air costs 40. What is that? What's their dollar they use? That 40 francs per minute.
Swiss francs. Yeah, I hemorrhaged cash while I was there. I could really go down the list of like insane prices. I think the thing that took my breath away the most was one plate of salad that I got from, so Art Basel outside of Unlimited had like a pop-up restaurant that was just a progressive, organic, vegan and vegetarian. It was basically a salad bar for all intents and purposes. It was 42 francs,
cheap.
Which is like
cheap.
Basically $50 for a salad. I mean, it's kind of offensive. And then you start understanding why people are always wanting to know if there's going to be free food at an event, you know?
Well, okay, so we're not going to spend this episode going through your Basel experience. If you're disappointed, audience, we're sorry. But there's a good reason for that.
The reason is you should be subscribed to Gagosian.com and join my newsletter. And you can read all about this fair, previous fairs, and upcoming fairs as I travel around the world following the art world circus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I chronicle my experiences. Each one tends to be different when I go to different cities and different years with different economic situations.
So, yeah, guys, we're not going to spoil it here, but make sure you subscribe to Gagosian.com. Read the report. It should be out. When do you say? Coming.
I'm going to say in the next 2 days. I'm going to really dive into it tomorrow, and I'll either have it done tomorrow or by the next day. I feel pretty locked and loaded. This was a great experience. I can say this without spoiling too much because I've done it enough times now that I know exactly what to go and how to look around.
Yeah, you're like a machine.
I've refined the experience, and right. I did this trip alone, and I didn't know. Sometimes I have like wingmen on these trips.
Is that what I am to you? A wingman?
Not you, but I'll have like a friend staying with me, or I'll go with you to a fair. And then that tends to be like a negotiation. But when I go alone, I can go into stealth mode. You know, I can hunt
Leo
like
DiCaprio.
A wolf.
Yeah,
exactly. And I can just go. And if I want to talk to people, great. But if not, I can just walk around, observe, listen. And that's what I did on this trip. So I had a much more reflective, slow, but deeply internalized experience of this fair versus other ones where sometimes they can be very like, over here, look over here, come over here, do this. This was not this trip. This trip was very methodically orchestrated.
Could we say it was very Swiss?
It was very. I'm becoming more and more Swiss every time.
She comes home and she's rocking a Swiss hat from the airport that she got.
Yeah.
And just wearing Swiss sneakers. I don't know.
Swiss
I don't know.
Watch.
I don't know who you've become. So, guys, we still got a great episode for you this week. So, firstly, some big moves have happened in the art world, particularly the Perrotin thing, and we want to talk about what it means.
I'm going to ask a few questions. I want to get your take on the class structure within the realm of the artist. Mm-hmm. And then I also want to ask what is to me a deep and profound question that has come up very recently, which is if an artist has 10 assistants, but their work is painting in abstraction, and they have 10 assistants making their abstract paintings, are those paintings fundamentally theirs?
Okay, that's spicy. All right, we're going to get into it. Welcome back, guys, to Art Smack. All right, we got some big news coming from one of the biggest art galleries in the world.
Yeah, what would you say? It's in the top 8.
You think it's the top 8?
Within the top 8.
I would agree with that.
We're definitely not number 1, but definitely, and definitely not number 3, not number 4, but maybe 5, 6, 7, or 8.
Somewhere around that. We are talking about Perrotin Gallery. Jerry, you know a little bit about Perrotin Gallery. Mm-hmm. Maybe the history. Could you just explain what Perrotin Gallery is? Who's over there?
Yeah.
What's their kind of structure and story? I think it'd be helpful to set the table before we talk about some big news with Perrotin this week.
So I've been actually a fan of this gallery for a long time. And I actually have good things to report about the gallery, at least from my friends who have worked there or worked with them as artists. Mm-hmm.
We were just there 2 weeks ago.
We were just there. So it is a big global international gallery started by Emmanuel Perrotin. He has a couple spaces, or maybe 2 or 3 spaces in Paris right now. Mm-hmm. He has a place in Shanghai. He has, obviously, gallery in New York. He has more than that. These are just the ones that I'm very aware of. And Emmanuel is not a Nepo baby. That's something to be noted. I really like and admire about him. He built this from the ground up. It seems like the art world up at the top is basically right now, there's a couple self-starters, but it tends to be mostly Nepo babies or people born into some kind of wealth. But then there definitely are people that are at the top that started it within their own lifetimes and are doing incredibly well.
And started in one small, square foot selling artists that no one knew and just built.
Well, when I spoke to Emmanuel, I interviewed him on Instagram Live a long time ago, like the beginning of the pandemic. And he explained to me that he was very young. I think he had started working for a more traditional art dealer because back in the 80s, he told me, you know, art dealing wasn't considered very cool. It was mostly like people selling old masters, uh-huh. some modernism, some abex, but like very little.
Contemporary art wasn't.
Yeah, contemporary art was not a thing. But he was working for someone else and he kind of decided to start his own gallery. And then he got very into contemporary, modern and contemporary art, and then really started focusing on contemporary. And I would say if you look at his roster and you look at what he's been doing, he pretty much only sells contemporary art.
Yeah. Some estates from older artists, but you're right. I mean, it's very contemporary.
Yeah.
I think one of the works and artists that put, I think, Perrotin on the map in kind of the public culture was the banana. Do you remember the banana?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's just one of many things.
The Maurizio Catalan banana back in Basel like 3 or 4 years ago, that was a Perrotin thing that caused such a freaking ruckus in mainstream media too.
Yeah, that turned into a meme, basically.
Yeah. So he's been working with Maurizio Catalan, Daniel Arsham, Murakami. I mean, the roster is...
He has a great... he just worked with my friend Cara Jocelyn. He worked with Henry Gunderson, as we've talked about before. I mean, the list is like very who's who. Everyone's trying to get their hands on whatever he's selling. So, I mean, it's very highly sought after. A little bit on the hypey side, I would say.
Yeah, he worked with, what are they called? The Basel ATM guys, Mischief. Mm-hmm. He's been working with Mischief, and I went to their show. Mischief is probably one of like the buzziest, hottest art collectives today. So yeah, anything else on Perrotin, kind of the background?
I want to say on the work-life side, from what I've heard, and the reason I've heard it's very good is because it's allegedly run very democratically. So once you're a staff member, no matter what your role is, they vote in like who's going to show and where. So it's very like everyone can sort of contribute and have a voice. So it's not siloed. Like there's some art galleries, and I've worked in them before a long time ago, where it's like you get in a role and they sort of assess you very early on, like what they see for you or what they think you're going to be. And who your family is and what your connections are and what you're capable of. And then they basically just expect you to stay within your lane. And I've heard that it is just not the case at Periton, where, you know, you can actively take on responsibility, bring in artists, people vote, and you can actually like grow within the organization, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. So here's the story, guys. Colony Investment Management has entered into talks with Periton Gallery to buy a 60% stake in the contemporary art business. Colony Investment Management is a private equity firm based in Paris that's been around for 20 or 30 years. They like to focus on businesses that they invest in that have a lot of real estate. So they'll do deals with hospitality groups like hotel groups. I'm not sure, and I don't think they've ever done an art gallery business, but they have entered into a due diligence period. The deal isn't finalized. The money hasn't transferred, but letters of intent have been signed. They've agreed to a price. And typically in these processes now, they go into what's called due diligence phase. Well, they'll look at all the books, they'll, I don't know, contracts. They'll try to understand the business deeply. They open the kimono for everything that the company does. Mm-hmm. And then they're saying that the deal should close sometime in the fall of this year.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a 60% stake here. People might ask, well, how much is that worth? We don't actually know. There has been not a public indication of what the value of this business is. So what 60% is in terms of a dollar value.
Mm-hmm.
One report stated that Periton does 100 million plus in sales per year. Do you buy that? Do you think that that's accurate? In sales, meaning the value of paintings sold. Obviously, there's commissions to the artists, which don't go to the gallery. So maybe they like... the revenue of the business is 50% of that. I don't know.
That's like how much a month?
Like under 10, like 8 to 10, something like that, 7.5.
Well, you have to think. I mean, I guess I buy that if you think, how many galleries does he have?
Oh,
He's also at every single fair, not him personally, but the gallery. Periton Gallery is at every major fair. And they also do some regional fairs in like Asia and the Middle East.
And in addition, they also do secondary sales. They opened up a secondary sales practice. And
how many galleries do they have?
So there's at least like 7, 8, 9, 10 gallery
spaces.
So
it's very believable that they sell that much.
And I was going to say secondary practice plus the store, the e-commerce store, which probably drives not crazy amounts of sales, but some. So I do believe that. But what did you think when you read this news? Was it surprising to see a gallerist sell the majority stake of his business in the art gallery business, which doesn't happen very often?
No. So first of all, we are going through this massive professionalization growth spurt in the art world. I mean, when I came to the art world, started working like 12 years ago, there weren't contracts really. I mean, not working contracts. A lot of things were just handshake done, you know, everything from what it was like to work there to how deals were done, who they were done with. Everything was sort of, I don't know what the word is, but it was kind of a realm of trust, and you really just had your name and your reputation. And if you broke that, allegedly, you know, you were sort of like cast out from the Garden of Eden.
Is it fair to say that it was just a network of effectively like mom and pop shops?
Yeah, high net worth individuals who were sort of trading cards. But I'm sure, and I've heard, you know, even in obviously the 90s, it was like that. The early 2000s. The art world went through a big growth spurt, which could probably be correlated with things like Art Basel in Miami coming.
Right. Yeah, Miami.
And then Freeze eventually coming to New York. So I think that the story of the corporatization and the professionalization of art and the truly the globalization, which means art fairs at any given moment all over the world, multiple locations for galleries, because as this business grew, you know, when we came, when the recession came in 2008, a lot, this is our inflation problem now, like a lot of money was pumped into the system, a lot of dollar bills. And that is how the art market rebounded, essentially, and which has been good for a lot of people, including artists. And so as it has grown and it has gotten more and more attention, and it's basically on the precipice of being in the mainstream consciousness. It may not be for everyone, but to some extent it is. Like Art Basel is, when you say Art Basel, whether people think of Switzerland or they think of Miami, it's sort of like Coachella. Like yeah. You hear that and you think like, oh yeah, it's a big
festival.
We've
talked about that before. It's so one of those things.
The art world is becoming, you know, more and more people, and this is again a good thing, like can name artists, you know, for better or worse, like Kusama, you know, or Murakami, or I don't know why I just named two Japanese artists, but right. You know, like it's definitely infiltrating the consciousness of the global sort of pop culture community. Mm-hmm. So all this stuff to say that as the art world, like other industries, picked itself up after the big fall in 2008, there, I think that the people within the art world started realizing, okay, if we don't want this to happen and we want to be on more firm ground so that if we do hit another big bump, like we can land quicker on our feet. I think this is when the idea of sort of becoming more corporate and acting more like a corporation and treating art as a brand and an asset became the goal.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up the word brand, because the website Axios, which doesn't cover a lot of art stuff, they're typically politics and business, they had a piece that came out yesterday called How the Art World Went Corporate. And it really was stemmed from this Paraton deal. And then they went through some other examples and talked about how Art Basel just wrapped up. And they quoted the new CEO of Art Basel, mm-hmm. Noah Horowitz, saying, quote, "People are ever more driven by brand," adding that they buy from Art Basel galleries because we are brand. I don't know if people were talking about brand 15 years ago in the art business. I mean, maybe the auction houses.
No, because it used to just be names.
Yeah. Now they're trying to do a brand. Like, it doesn't actually matter who controls, you know, the person. It's the brand of the gallery, the brand of the art fair, the brand of the artist. Like, we're going to get into whether artists, when they use their, you know, their staff of people to create works for them, it's really a branding thing. It's people are buying the brand, not the artist's hand.
It's like buying Chanel or Hermes or all those major fashion labels. It's interesting because I remember, I always say like Hildy 1.0 in New York, that period of time when I first came to New York in 2013 to work at galleries and stuff. And I remember that I had read a lot about fashion in the 90s and how, or fashion in the 80s and the 90s, because before that, yes, very wealthy people had access to brands, but people weren't as brand obsessed mm-hmm. back in the day. It was more like, does it look cool? Does it look cute? Right. Is it in style? That was more a question. Like, is it in style? It wasn't as like logo brand obsessed. And then it was actually Donna Karan who did something very interesting. What she did was she was the first one to take this blue chip name that she had made for herself in the fashion world and to say, I wonder if I could just put she started making ready to wear. And I wonder if I could just put the trade off is the clothes are cheaper and they're maybe more quickly made. So like ready to wear, that's what ready to wear is. But the trade off would be these people would be doing marketing for her by putting like a big DKNY on things. And she was the first one to kind of do it. And then really quickly, like Tommy Hilfiger started doing it.
Halston.
Yeah. All these brands started following in her footsteps. And that's when brand and logo recognition in the fashion world got very big. And that's when fashion was actually able to make the leaps and the bounds that it did from being this esoteric thing that only the super elite 1% knew about or whatever. I don't know what that statistic is, to being like something that was accessible to more people.
Yeah, mass market. Right.
And I remember my first time coming to New York having read that, and I would, you know, this is back when I drank, we'd go to bars and I'd be like, well, why doesn't anybody in the art world like take cues from the fashion world and what they've done? And it wasn't because I knew any better yet, but I remember like instigating outrage amongst my older, more, you know, established and snobbier friends at the time, who were very adamant that, you know, a gallery was a steward of the artist's work and art is like this precious thing. It's not a commodity. It's visual culture and storytelling, and it's this glue that binds us and holds us together, and it communicates all the, you know, just insert a word for something that is special. And I just remember thinking like, I really bought their arguments. I was like, sure, yeah, I agree, because I love art. But at the same time, I remember thinking like, this is not good business. As little as I knew about business, anybody could see that this is not sustainable long term if you want to take things. Now, fast forward literally 10 years later, we're in a completely different world where I think these galleries have been around long enough that they have established their mythology,
right,
their origin story, their brand, their quote unquote mission statement for what each gallery is. And then that means it's been around long enough, like Chanel, you know, like Chanel had to be established and there had to be a story about her life and all this stuff before somebody like Karl Lagerfeld could step in, mm-hmm, and it could be this big corporation and he could add to the legacy by throwing hit, you know. So now these galleries are, you know, Perrotin's like 30 years old. You know that, right?
Yeah.
Like all these galleries are pretty old. They are established. They are sort of brand names. And now they can have private equity or these other companies coming in and investing in the brand itself. Makes sense.
It totally does. I think you nailed it. It's like, and I was reading about the Perrotin deal specifically. They said, so correction on just the revenue. Perrotin is close to $150 million per year. And they do that with no debt and in a steady cash flow generating way, which for an investment company like a private equity firm, music to their ears. So what you just said about establishing the brand and getting the business going, bullseye. They've nailed it and now they're ready for like the capital infusion. And like you said, this happened with fashion too. I remember when the Halston stuff was coming out on Netflix and the documentaries, a big core plot of that was Halston was the boutique guy. And then he got an investment from some big fashion holding company that decided to take him and his brand to Macy's, to JCPenney, and into luggage and accessories and all this stuff. And then the couture business was this thing, but then also the real money was in the licensing and just getting it out there. So I'm looking at, this morning I woke up and I was thinking about this and I put together a list of what I would call art world corporatizing events that have happened with just in the last, like, I would say 7 years, I mean, 5 years even, this tight list. So one, the Perrotin thing, for sure. Gagosian announcing the board of directors. The Bare Facts getting an investment from private equity. Pace acquiring Kane Griffin, remember that?
Mm-hmm.
That got like brushed over, but there was mergers in the gallery space. I think generally people like Jeff Koons, Richard Prince, Damien Hirst have become corporations,
mm-hmm,
with huge staffs and different functions, and they're basically companies. Sotheby's buying art agency partners, Sotheby's themselves being a subject to a leveraged buyout by the current owner, Christie's launching a venture capital firm, Bonhams Auction House is buying a bunch of regional auction houses and trying to consolidate. one of our favorite, LGDR. Now it's in their merger. And even in the art media, something like Art News and Penske Media. Like, I don't think these things would have happened 15, 10 years ago. I mean, this just wasn't, I don't think the market, like your, to your point, was mature enough to handle these types of like corporate financial transactions. Mm-hmm. And Axios talks about the brand thing, which we've been hitting on here, and how there's a generational change in terms of who buys art. Baby boomers, who dominated the art market for decades, are now generally more interested in bequeathing their collections, passing them on, than they are to adding to them. Mm-hmm. But millennials, compared to Gen X, they're more likely to embrace corporate brands rather than reject them out of hand. So they're saying, like, the studies are showing with consumer behavior that millennials are more attracted to brands, you know. So there's also a play on that. And millennials, they're about to experience the greatest wealth transfer this the United States has ever seen between the boomers and the younger generations. The millennials mostly benefiting from that. I like this.
Kind of stepped over the Gen Xers.
Well, I wanted to bring this up because I think Axios called you a Gen Xer.
Me?
Yeah. Let me read this. Hold on. Because they were going through a list of other corporatizing events in the art world.
Right.
And they said Gallery Perrotin, Gagosian, the Supreme Court with the Warhol case. And, quote, Gen Xers in the art press are sneering at the wave of, quote, Gmail art advisors who, like the new collectors they advise, are more interested in cash than art. Yeah. Didn't you come up with Gmail art advisors?
Yeah. For the record.
Yeah.
I invented that term.
Well, apparently you're now Gen X instead of millennial.
Oh, okay. Well,
let me ask a question. Why do you think, after all we've just discussed, and maybe we'll wrap up with this, why do you think Emmanuel decided to take this action at this point? It says he has growth plans. That's what the press release says.
Yeah.
You know, this is going to help him achieve new heights, and they're going to help him with his real estate. They're a real estate-focused group. Mm-hmm. But, you know, why do you think? Do you think there's anything else there?
I mean, it's probably good to put in a succession plan. He's not
Bingo.
He's not a spring chicken. I mean, he's probably almost in his 60s. That's not old, but, you know, I'm sure a succession plan is intended. And then also, galleries like Perrotin, Almine, Rec, like these mega minus galleries is what I call them. Just anyone outside of the top four mega galleries. They have tremendous pressure to compete and not be cannibalized by the other bigger galleries in the market. And I think everyone, because there isn't a precedent, everyone is trying to figure out what the smoothest next step is. And I think it is pretty brave of Emmanuel to do this. I can't remember what we were talking about, but basically, oh, it wasn't you and I talking. It was a podcast that I was having a conversation with in my head. But it was, I was listening to the Vox Today Explain podcast, and they were talking about Apple and all of Apple's like massive success. And they said, the interesting thing is if you go back and you study each product that they've released, that they've just nailed it with every time, everything from the iPod, the iPad, the iPhone, like everything AirPods that they've done.
Yeah.
They're like, they were never the first ones. They always let other people, and now the headset, right?
Right.
They let other companies try to do it first, mm-hmm. and then they perfected or improved upon it. And so I actually had a conversation with some people from Perrotin when I was in Miami about this. And I wasn't saying it to be negative, but I meant it like it's very brave to line up to be the first one because this was inevitable.
Right.
A major gallery. I mean, other galleries already are about to do this or are doing it. But
we're talking to people, yeah.
Yeah, but he was the first one who did it. And I guess he had to ask from his staff and from the other senior leadership at the gallery, like, please, like, back me up, get behind me. This is the right thing for us to do. And, you know, his gallery again, and this is not a paid advertisement for Periton, but he has staff members who have been with him basically from the beginning.
Right.
A lot of his senior directors, people have been around for a long time.
Not a lot of turnover there too, even people who join recently, like other galleries where they're in for 6 months and they hate it so much. Yeah. Like, people stick around.
People stick around 9 years, 15 years, like long time. So everyone that I've spoken to that works at the gallery trusts Emmanuel and trusts that he's good on his word and he's going to do something great with this injection of cash.
Right.
And allegedly, you know, this company, Colony, is going to be basically a silent partner. I don't know how that's going to work, but that's the word on the street from people at the gallery that have talked to me, that like they're going to let the gallery continue to be run as it runs and just expand that.
Right. So even though they're the majority owners now at 60%, maybe they have voting rights about what's...
They're not going to be curating exhibitions.
No, then they're not. They're probably not going to, like, if Emmanuel wants to make a decision, like show a banana on the wall, they're gonna let him do it. My take about why he did it, I agree with you. Succession, planned. If the brand is already established, you don't want to have this key man problem. Like this allows them to be more agile, allows them to firm up any sort of ground that they've made in the market with real institutional money. It allows them probably to expand via a real estate strategy. I'm sure in Colony's portfolio, they have opportunities to just expand their real estate footprint. And people, I always have this question. It's like, why does someone sell their business? Especially if their business, like reports are saying, it's profitable, right? If Periton in and of itself is generating profits of millions of dollars a year, why would someone want to sell that? Don't you want to sell when things are, you know, going bad, or you want to get out, or you're just really, really old? Emmanuel is, like you said, you think he's close to 60s, but that's pretty young relatively to still keep working in this industry. But you know what? As much dollars as he's going to get from this, maybe that's worth more today, like taking a huge profit windfall today. I don't know what it is, $50 million or something, than like it being doled out over the next 15, 20 years of grinding.
Yeah.
You know, a dollar today is worth more than a dollar in the future. That's like a corporate finance principle. And like, you get why someone wants to just cash out. You've built this thing for 30 years. The market meets the opportunity. Why not be rewarded in that kind of way? I totally understand why he did it.
Yeah.
I did.
And this could be...
The floodgates are opening?
Floodgates opening. Yeah, 100%.
Private equity companies are competitive with each other.
Yeah.
If Colony sees value in this space, Colony's competitors for deals will also look at this space too.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to say that, you know, Art Basel's always had corporate sponsorship in the sense that it was, you know, major banks and whatnot. But now that MCH is...
Oh, that was another corporatizing thing I didn't even mention. Yeah, MCH.
Now that MCH is major shareholder in the company, it makes sense. I guess we could say that Art Basel is the brand, the company, when I say Art Basel, not the experience itself, is probably a key, what would you call it, key market leader or indicator of where to go and what to do.
Right. Yeah.
Because if somebody, you know, if a company like MCH saw as much opportunity, I mean, who knows? I hope this doesn't become the Hiltonization or the Wyndham or the...
Yeah.
Or the Marriottization of art.
Or Walmart, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. That would suck. But yeah, something is happening. Major tectonic plates are shifting.
Yeah. I wanted to say, this is for like my finance nerds that listen to this, all two of you. A private equity company buys something like this, they're looking for a few things. And I was looking at Colony's website and their investment strategy and what they do. They invest in businesses that have real estate in the asset on the balance sheet. Mm-hmm. So that signaled to me that, unlike some galleries, you'd be surprised, a lot of them don't own the real estate that they're exhibiting in. even though they did renovations and they have all these floors and signage and all this stuff, like they usually rent. Very few actually own these properties. So for this company to go in and acquire this stake, based on their strategy, it seems like Periton owns a lot of their real estate. Maybe people knew that, but to me, that gives confirmation. And they feel comfortable enough, typically in a private equity transaction, you use a lot of debt. And they feel that the cash flow that the business generates, plus the protection of these real estate properties, that if things went south, they could sell them and just make some of their money back. They felt comfortable putting in this money. The last point I want to say, because I've talked about this so much, is people with investment money, when you're looking at the art world, buying into a gallery with a brand that's established that sells paintings is probably the best place you can put your cash. If you're really itching to be invested in the art world, it's not in softwares and new technologies that could disrupt. We've always talked about this in the podcast. The value creation within art is the buying and selling of paintings. And if you can get attached and run parallel with a great buyer or seller of paintings like a gallery, that's where the real value is.
Okay, so I have a question. Do you think that, because it has been very poo-pooed, this idea, for example, like corporate collections, like people like kind of cringe.
Like the investment Citibank. Banks all have it, yeah.
Like Citibank, UBS, corporate collection, like Credit Suisse or
they all have it. They all DSB. Have it. JP Morgan, yeah. All of them.
But I wonder when we're going to see the first sort of blue check approved art hedge fund will start. Because I'm betting that that's next, because when we were looking at that announcement this morning, we were talking about all the different corporatization
events.
Yeah. I was thinking maybe now that the cat is just so fully out of the bag that yes, art is treated as a commodity and as an, you know, asset. Maybe it'll finally be more socially acceptable to just be like, I'm starting an art hedge fund, and people won't feel uncomfortable about it anymore.
I don't know. We shall see what happens in this space.
Maybe that's what I'll do after business.
Yeah, it sounds like a good plan. We'll see what happens. I do think, in summary, this is a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
I think, like you said, this might open up a floodgates for other investment groups to look at art gallery businesses specifically as perhaps places to put money. So
it's not a bad thing. I mean,
I don't think it's a bad thing.
It has this potential for sure of taking the sort of self-appointed seriousness out of art and some of the, you know, the art with a fine art with a capital F, capital A. Especially like when it comes to paintings, sculptures, stuff like that. Very traditional, fine art. Really thinks incredibly highly of itself. These artists do. They're curators. They're handlers. They're dealers. They take it, obviously, very, very seriously. Now, when a large corporation comes and or a private equity... Yeah. At a certain point, there's going to be reviews, right? There's going to be financial analysis that's sort of ongoing.
How do we improve the business?
How do we improve? Hey. And that could be that artist didn't sell well one or two shows. Cut that fat. And it could be like, no, that's actually just a very important artist that we need in the contemporary dialogue. And that has been the freedom that the art market and the art world has retained in its little isolationist bubble. And now that we have invited in money, you are making a deal, because you are no longer just responsible for your money. You're responsible for those who have invested in you. And they're going to want to see results. And if they don't, I can imagine people having meetings being like, you know, you've showed this artist
right
two times, the sales weren't great, get him out of here.
And this one has been doing so well, show this one more.
Yeah.
There's definitely a risk of that as institutions come into the space, because this is what's happened in all industries. There's a very famous story called Barbarians at the Gate, which was RJR Nabisco. This is like a a book from the 80s, famous business book about really the foundations of private equity and what they do. And the takeaway from that story was you come in, you cut costs like crazy. But there's other ways to do it, other more responsible ways to really invest in a business and help it grow. And private equity does this all the time, as much of a bad rep as they get. And I have faith that that's one of those situations here. That won't mean that the next one won't be a barbarians at the gate situation.
Oh, I've got to read that. That sounds really good.
All right.
Well, we, you know, wish everyone at Periton a
hope the deal
smooth ascension into the realm of private equity. And for the artists that are going along for that ride, I
Godspeed.
Hope it's smooth for you. And don't worry, you're still an artist, even if it's you're a corporate artist now, corporately funded artist.
Good luck and diligence.
Yeah.
Make it through.
Yeah. Okay, I have a question.
What's up, Jer? Jer Bear.
Okay. So, we all know, most people know, that throughout history, many artists don't actually make their own work.
Yes.
Because conceptually, that is understood and accepted. And, you know, historically, there's always been this idea of apprenticeship and people training under the Raphael school, the Michelangelo school. And then those people essentially were assistants who made paintings on behalf of these artists. But then we fast forward to contemporary art, and it's very, very common. Even me, with works that I make, I work with fabricators, right? And I come up with a concept, and I obviously self-fund, or I fund the project, and then we work together to materialize something that was but an idea.
Right.
This is all common practice, very accepted within the contemporary art discourse. But there's one little area that seems to be a black hole to me. And it's this idea of abstraction. Because in my opinion, abstraction is nothing but the material and physical manifestation of the soul, like the soul, S-O-U-L, via the hand, that precious hand being driven to gesturally apply paint in colors, allow for happy accidents. You know, there's really no replacing, in my idea, the artist's hand from abstraction. However, I've recently heard that one in particular, but I'm sure this person's not the only one, a very highly sought after, popular, contemporary, abstract painter has a studio with 10 plus assistants who make their abstract paintings for them.
Are you serious?
Yes. So my question is, who actually is the artist when someone is making an abstract painting, even if it's within a studio context?
Jeez. Okay. Let's explore. All right. You mentioned the Renaissance schools and how they were structured, where the master is certainly not completely devoid of their hand on the painting. I think there's anecdotes of them doing the hands, for example, of the religious scenes, or the faces. But a lot of the details were painted in by the assistants, the apprentice, or something like that. Like, there are certain core pieces of the work that always the master artist would take care of. And my understanding of contemporary times, at least in the figurative space, is that that basically holds true. That figurative painters today will often have, especially at the higher levels, often have assistants that assist them with things like the background, or if there's flowers in the fields or something, and the assistant will take care of those types of things, maybe do framing if there's some sort of building or some sort of interior.
But I mean, I've heard, and I've seen, because I've been to a lot of studio visits, that it's actually not exclusive. Technically, the assistants will do everything for figurative painters.
Well, like someone like Koons, right? For sure.
Oh, I mean, I could name names, but I'm actually, no. If you go to Jonas Wood's studio, mm-hmm. he has a magnificent painting factory, basically. But what he comes up with first is he sources all the imagery. Mm-hmm. So a lot of his source imagery is like photographs he encounters, things on the internet that he encounters.
Sports things, yeah.
Sports things. And then he, as far as I understand it, will make this initial collage that'll sort of turn into the drawing, the line drawing, that then is made bigger and all these paintings are based off of. But the assistants, you know, will assist in every single way of essentially coloring in the painting. Right?
Right, by his direction.
But he builds the bones of what each work of art is going to be.
So yeah, so that's more or less what I've seen. I've seen some artists actually say, okay, yeah, you do the background, I do the figure, or I do the right. subject or something like that. But hey, I have to do, you know, I have this commission and I have this solo show and I have this art fair and I have this museum project and like, I need help. Mm-hmm. I need help to expedite this process. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, considering the legacy of that. Mm-hmm. But to your question on abstraction, it's pretty fascinating. I mean, we're talking about a totally different approach to mark making and image creating.
Mark making, great.
Right, race. And just imagine this, and I'll pose this rhetoric to you. Like, imagine if Jackson Pollock works were done by the studio hand. Mm-hmm. Or de Kooning.
Or Rothko.
Right. I don't know. I don't, like, can you, it would be very weird for me to think that would be acceptable or okay.
Well, it's not like, is it okay? But I guess the authorship is a bit in question. Like, for example, it's funny because authorship is something that one of the first things that I think they love to do when they pop your cherry in art school is like destroy this notion of authorship. But to get into NYU, like to actually start, I have to take a plagiarism test. And I was just downstairs because it's going to take me like, it's a 2-hour test. It's like they're super strict about it, right? And you have to read all these different rules about very specific case studies of what is considered plagiarism, what is not considered plagiarism. And when I was just downstairs right before this conversation, I was reading it. They were like talking about, you know, if a person, even if you're paraphrasing what another person says, or rewording it, you still have to cite them
right.
and give them credit. Even if you're now going to use your own words, you can't like make word salad. You have to always give credit. And we were talking this morning about
TikTok
and how like these dances now you can easily go back and trace who the originator is because the app basically forces you to give credit to the originator of the content of the initial dance, even if somebody remakes it, reenacts it again in a different country, in a different time, whatever. So these are all interesting. These are, you know, citations in academia. Mm-hmm. That's not art. Dance is art, you know, and they force a citation basically in TikTok.
So
through a tag.
So in the case of this abstract painter.
But an abstraction, which is meant to be this sort of spiritual mark making, for lack of a better term, that is highly identifiable to an artist because it comes allegedly from their hand and is, I can't remember the exact definitions, but there are definitions of what abstraction are. There's general parameters, which are things like creative impulse, you know, being impulsive creatively, mm-hmm. like allowing, you know, yourself to be, it, and it's highly individualized is my point.
Okay, so here's where I want to, because you just brought this up and I had a kind of a memory of a line in a textbook that I read. So let's just use the example of the gestural painters, Abex, versus, what do they call it, color field. Mm-hmm. Now, let's go back even earlier, like to Kandinsky and Malevich. Like, there is something about the subject matter of what abstract is depicting. Some abstract artists, for sure, it's a depiction, a mark making of the inner soul, someone like Pollock or something like that. But there are other abstract painters, particularly in the history of it, in the early stages, where what they were doing was the subject of the work was the color, or was mm-hmm. the circle, or right. was the abstract object. So if, in that context, if you look at it through that lens, if someone's making a painting about the color red or something, and maybe it's not like purely gestural, you know, performative, that whole Pollock thing, then why is it a problem if they have a studio where they have someone who helps them create a painting about the color red, or about circles, or about shapes, or about other abstract forms? I know, I guess circle is a subject, but you know what I mean? Like, if what they're trying to pick is the subject is something like
but
abstract, but then why can't you have someone do that for you?
Because I think you're talking about, God, this sounds like some art school shit. You're talking about the difference between conceptual art and abstraction, which is also what I'm talking about.
Right.
If somebody's making something about the circle, just the idea of the circle, or the idea of what a chair is, or the idea of what right. the color red is, that's conceptual art. But if you're making gestural abstraction and mark making, you know, a Cy Twombly, all these names that we've just
right.
listed out, that is something that is, in my understanding of reality and my understanding of art, fundamentally about the artist themselves.
I agree with that. So I think I was trying to parse it by saying, like, if the abstract painter, they're doing a subject matter of the color red or whatever, and they have this structure, like, or a shape, like Ellsworth Kelly or something, I can see where having the studio hand, I think I could get comfortable with that. But when it comes to, like, a gestural painter who is really, if you look at a painting, it's the classic stuff where, like, my mom is like, I could do this, this looks like a mess, da 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 da, that whole thing.
Wanda.
I think, yeah, it's really hard for me to, I mean, look, is it still their work in today's context and how people view it? I think the answer is yes. But for me personally, it leaves a little bit of an icky taste in my mouth, learning that that's how the work is made and the credit goes to them. Like, I always assume that the high-end blue chip gestural painters were doing all their own work. Maybe they had studio assistants helping them mix colors, or maybe plan things, or just in these, you know, cataloging and finance, whatever it is. Like, of course, you have studio assistants. When it comes to the mark making, I always thought that came from the artist. Yikes. Yeah.
Well, okay. So then it comes. So this is where the class question comes in, because I was mm-hmm. thinking about it and I was like, okay, well, in this specific context, it really sounds like the artist who has the studio, who's now making their gestural abstract paintings for them, is more the commissioner or the patron
yeah.
of the second class artist, who is the layperson, you know, who is the one.
The laborer, yeah.
That is physically doing the thing. And there a class system is born, right?
Yeah. I buy that.
So
would you call it like first class, second class, or how would you categorize?
I would categorize it like, how did we do it earlier? We were talking about it. We're like upper class. I would categorize it like upper class, middle class, lower class, or even I would say the middle and the lower class are more the working class in this scenario. And the upper class are the concept makers and the pointers. Do this, do that, make it like this. And then the middle class artist is either an artist that is still making their work. They're still making the work. Mm-hmm. And then the lower class artist in this sense. And again, remember, this isn't like a moral assignment to anyone,
right,
based on where you're at if you're listening to this. I'm just trying to organize this information as I receive it. Then the lower class would be maybe, yeah, like the paint mixer, the person who gessos a canvas, who puts the canvas on stretcher bars. Uh-huh. Like that's kind of the lower end of this pecking order. And artists now are much like these brands we're talking about. Artists are brands, or they're brand directors, right? They're
like the creative
directors. So they're creative directing their career. And these artists that are on lower rungs are, you know, the more middle management, and then like the laborers. And I never thought of it that way until I started thinking about this whole thing, about this artist who's known for their abstract paintings.
That is gestural, right?
Gestural abstract paintings.
That's the key.
Not conceptual abstract, gestural. And they don't even make them. And it's so funny, because I don't like this person's work personally, back when they made their own work.
You're going to tell me offline who it is, right?
Yeah, I'll tell you later. But
I'm sure people are like, oh my God, who's she talking about?
Yeah, sorry, I'm not going to name drop here because it's just not my business. But it's so funny because I don't like the work. But two friends of mine at Art Basel, we were going through their recent work that was up at the fair and stuff that, like, I guess was disseminated via PDF. Mm-hmm. And I was like, whoa, I was like, these works don't look like they're made at all by the same person at all. And they, like, each painting looks incredibly different. You could use significantly different adjectives to describe each one of their new paintings. And as my friend pointed out, they're not making them. So of course they don't look, because I liked one. I was like, oh, that one's kind of interesting. I like that one. And I never liked their paintings. And they're like, yeah, because they didn't make that. Their assistants,
I guess. Their assistant's super talented.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, well, that's funny. So it kind of threw me into a bit of a existential conundrum. I mean, can an artist just do this? Of course we know the answer is going to be yes, right? Because this is the way...
That's the current standard.
This is the standard, exactly. Right. But something about it, you said icky?
Yeah, it gives me a little bit of ick. Yeah. A little bit of like, if I had the income to swim in those waters and I found that piece of information, it would for sure affect my buying decision, for sure.
Yeah.
I would have like this moral thing inside me to be like, I get, again, in the figurative side, I get the studio hand, I get, you know, all that. But when it comes to gestural abstract work, like, What am I acquiring? What am I collecting here?
Yeah.
That goes back to like this whole idea of the brand thing. That's really a brand play that you're making if you're engaged with that
and
buying behavior.
How does it break down economically?
Well, we know.
Because a lot of times these second class or these middle class and working class or lower class, however you want to think of it, call them working class. It's less degrading than low.
It's not like low class.
But they are getting paid minimum wage.
$15 an hour.
You know, $20 an hour, part-time.
No health insurance.
They don't get health insurance. Yeah. They don't have 401ks. Meanwhile, these artists are
banked
millionaires and like packing it in. And it really begs, you know, there's always this thing in sort of the mythology of contemporary art and artists that somehow, I think Bruce Nauman's sort of responsible through this. There's this belief that artists are delivering messages from our higher powers in the unseen world into this physical realm. But they are just people. And I think this is a good way to wrap up, actually. As the art world continues to professionalize, class structures are really beginning to take root. And either we're going to have to change our tune about the mythology of it all, or we're going to have to begin to recognize and ask questions like, okay, I'm buying this painting for $500,000 from you. How much of that goes to your studio? And what's the breakdown of that for all these other people that are making the work? Because it's not just the artist anymore.
I'm wrangling with this. So what would you recommend someone who's working in a studio for a gestural abstract painter who's responsible for the majority of the stuff, at least what we end up seeing that goes into galleries, et cetera? Like, is there anything for them to do? Should they ask a certain question? Should they email us and tell us what's going on?
I mean, you know, not everybody wants to be or is meant to be an entrepreneur or their own boss or their own brand. Not everybody wants to do that.
Right.
That's fine. That's totally fine. I guess everybody has to just gut check themselves and really think about how they feel about somebody else, not just taking credit for the work that you've done, but also taking all the financial gain or a majority of it.
Come on, they're not even doing the, what's it called, MLA citation.
Except that's it. See, this is what I'm saying. Like, all of a sudden, I'm like, TikTok.
You're
copying. Plagiarism.
But AI, like all these things, the Warhol case.
Yeah.
Wow, would it take like a studio assistant to maybe like raise their hand legally? And maybe like, you know, try to see. I don't want to instigate that. That's a huge decision. I don't want anyone to think that we're advocating for that. But
I just think
maybe
everybody,
it does get there to a certain point.
I think you have to gut check yourself. Yeah. For sure. So I don't know. It's just food for thought. It's something for you guys as artists to think about and, you know, obviously email us.
Yes, please. In DM, email. I want to hear people's thoughts on this.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fundamental question, to pose it one more time, is a gestural abstract painter who relies upon the hand of their studio assistants and workers to make the paintings in full, who owns, who created that painting?
Who is the author of that?
Who is the author of that?
Yeah. So get at us with your thoughts and ideas about it. There maybe is. I'm doing too much navel gazing, but I also don't think I am. Because as we've just said, as the art world continues to grow and to professionalize, it might just be like in fashion when somebody says, I work for the House of Chanel.
Right.
Or I work for Tom Ford. We all know Tom Ford doesn't sit there with a sewing machine making and even designing, because there's so many items that he releases that clearly he doesn't design every single thing. It's just people that ghostwrite for him under his name.
Ghostwriting. That's another thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. This. Oof.
I'm telling you, this is a fucked up little.
But there's just
hole.
Something about the gestural thing that is different than a structured, you know, a garment or even a book or something. I don't know. Something about me about the abstract nature of it. I don't know. It's got to be by the artist's hand. Anyway, fascinating. Get at us, guys. Let us know.
Well, I guess we're going to wrap it up here. But again, if you've got Art Basel on your mind and you want to know more about what my experience was like this time, and you can go back and refer to the last three Art Basels, sign up, become a member so that you can receive the Jerry Report by going to gagosian.com. You sign up, you join, and the day that it's released, it will show up in your inbox, or you can always log in and retrieve the reports through your account there. So, you know, this is a great way for you to sort of stay abreast with the contemporary art world and the market, and come with me as I go on these little journeys that I really feel like I'm doing on behalf of my commissioners or patrons or whatever you want to think, which is you, the person that subscribes. So, you know, if you can spare the 10 or the 30 bucks, depending on where you want to be, and you're interested in where things are going, this is the Jerry Report. It's for you.
All right, guys, this has been episode 29. Thanks again for listening. Leave us a 5-star review. I don't think I've said that in a few episodes. iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, drop us a review. It really helps us. We're independent, and it helps us move up the rankings and lets more people find the show.
So, yep.
All right, Jerry.
See you on the internet.